Chapter 6, The Memory of Former Lives. A further objection to reincarnation is based upon the apparent absence of all memory of past lives. A little reflection, however, will show that recollection of the process of education is in no sense essential to possession of the acquired knowledge and faculty. We do not need to remember the processes of learning to walk, talk, read, and write in order to be able to do these things. Similarly, the absence of memory of incidents and experiences in past lives does not prevent the use of the resultant powers in later incarnations. Actually, the reincarnating ego does retain both the full memory of all incidents of past life cycles and all the capacities attained. Furthermore, just as remembrance of childish struggles when learning to walk, talk, read, and write is rarely retained in adult life, so recollection of the multifarious educative experiences of numerous preceding lives is not permitted to descend into the new mind brain. In consequence, the weight of the drama of previous existences is withheld, and the mind left free to investigate and assimilate new ideas. This withholding of memory may have been implied by classical references to the river Lethe in the lower world, the waters of which gave forgetfulness of the past. The fruits of past lives are expressed, however, in each new personality, as instinct and inherent gifts, as sympathies and antipathies, and as the voice of conscience. Furthermore, as will now be shown, many proven cases of accurate memory of former lives have been recorded. The solution of our fourth problem, presented by those who claim to remember past lives, now emerges. It is that in certain cases, such memories are true, and thereby constitute a strong additional evidence in support of the doctrine of rebirth. Regression of memory. Whilst the only final proof of the truth of the doctrine of reincarnation consists of direct knowledge of one's own past lives, convincing evidence is provided by Colonel de Rocha in his book Les Vies Successives. Therein, he describes experiments with various sensitives put into a trance state by hypnotism. By the process known as regression of memory, the operator succeeded in taking their subjects back to their former incarnations, thus obtaining details, often of a historical character, which, when checked later, were found to be entirely correct. In one typical instance, the sensitive chosen for an experiment was a young servant girl with little or no education and but a rudimentary knowledge of history, who, when taken back to her preceding life, described with a wealth of detail events, little-known incidents, ancient customs, and other matters of which she was completely ignorant in her present incarnation. Cases also thus recorded of children who, in full waking consciousness, remember details of their past lives, as in the classical case of Dr. Simona's twin daughters, possess an even greater evidential value. these cases for the most part deal with children who, dying in their early years, are almost immediately reborn, thus making more likely the recollection of their former lives. A former home discovered. The case of Madame Reynaud, for some time assistance to Dr. Durvel of Paris, offers convincing evidence of the theory of reincarnation. Madame Reynaud's memories of her former life arose spontaneously, in normal waking consciousness, and these memories were afterwards found to have been correct in every detail. From her earliest childhood, Madame Reynaud was haunted by the vision of an old house of peculiar architecture, situated in a beautiful park, under the clear blue skies of a southern land. On the terraces of this house, she saw herself, walking to and fro, sad and dejected, a prey to persistent ill health, and she affirmed that she had died there of consumption 100 years before, in her 25th year. In 1913, Madame Reynaud went to Italy for the first time, and on arriving at Genoa, immediately recognized it as the place of her former incarnation. The friends of Dr. Durville, with whom she was staying, at once volunteered to help in the search for her former home. But it was Madame Reynaud who guided them in their drive through the town, and finally led them to the house she had so often seen in her waking dreams. "Here it is. This is the place where I lived and died 100 years ago," she cried, as a sudden bend in the road revealed the entrance gates of an old country house. "Why," said her host, "this is the mansion of the family S. They are well known in Genoa, and it should not be difficult to make inquiries about the people who lived here in the last century." On the evening of that day, Madame Reynaud, whose psychic faculties seemed to have become enhanced by the sight of her former home, suddenly exclaimed, "I was not buried in a cemetery, as other people are. My body rests in a church. I feel sure of it." Circumstances did not allow Madame Reynaud to prolong her visit to Genoa, but after her return to Paris, Dr. Durville made careful inquiries among his Italian friends with the following result. In the archives of the Church of San Francisco del Barro, Genoa, are kept minutes of all the death certificates in the parish, in which is situated the house of the S family. Among these certificates was found the following entry, a copy of which was sent to Dr. Derby. 23rd of October, 1809. The Lady Joanna S, widow of Derby, for the past 2 years residing at her house in Albaro, always sickly, and whose ill health was during these last days aggravated by a chill, died on the 21st instant with all the sacraments of the church. And today, with our permission in writing, and with the authorization of the mayor, also in writing, her body was privately transported to and buried within the Church of Our Lady of the Mount. The usual signatures are appended. It will be noticed that this death certificate confirms Madame Reynaud's story on 3 important points: the approximate date of her death, her prolonged ill health, and the unusual fact that her remains had been buried in a church instead of the Genoa cemetery. Before these details were made known to Dr. D'Urville, thus excluding the possibility of unconscious telepathy, a sensitive whom he had hypnotized in the hope of obtaining details of Madame Moreno's past life at once described Genoa, described the Lady Joanna, spelt with some hesitation her family name, affirmed that she was now reincarnated, then suddenly exclaimed, "Why, is it possible? It is Madame Moreno. They are merged, one in the other. They are one and the same." Reunion after quick rebirth. Many other recorded instances exist of recollection of former lives. One remarkable case is recorded in Delhi, where a young Hindu girl of 8.5 years of age was successful in tracing the whereabouts of her old home and the relations of her past life. The story, as personally verified by a well-known member of the Theosophical Society, was printed in Theosophy in India, January to February 1936, when the case was still attracting attention. The girl, for the first 3 years of her childhood, did not talk. She appeared gloomy and contemplative, and from her 4th year, she began to speak about her home at Mutra, a place about 100 miles away from Delhi. But the parents and relations paid little heed. The child's teachers pronounced her quite intelligent, and some 3 or 4 years later, a neighbor, an advocate and close friend of the family, decided to investigate the case. The girl was in the habit of saying that in her old home she had plenty of sweets, fruit and money. She even described in detail the business of her husband, the location of the house, its plan and the colouring of its walls. She referred to her relations, and when her husband was mentioned, she used to bow her head in the customary respect. Although she gave the name of her brother-in-law, she could not utter that of her husband, as is also customary in India. She stated that she had been the mother of 2 children, the first of whom died while she was living. While she herself passed away from her last physical life 10 days after the birth of the 2nd child, a son. Pressure was brought to bear upon her to give the name of her husband to enable the advocate friend of the family to make further investigations. Her girlfriends, with whom she played, were asked to put the question to her, and for one of them she wrote the name on a slip of paper as K.C. of Mutra. This information had to be confirmed, and during the interval she continually asked her parents to take her to Mutra, her old home. Once, during a lesson, she began to cry and begged her teacher to take her to Mutra. The teacher was considerate and told her that it was not possible for this to be done unless she gave the name and address of her husband. Once more, she wrote her husband's name on a slip of paper as K.C. and handed it over to her teacher. This convinced the parents that her information was correct, and the advocate friend wrote a letter to Mr. K.C. at Mutra, making him acquainted with the facts of the case, little knowing that corroboration would be forthcoming. After a few days, Mr. K.C. replied that the incidents of his life related by the girl were correct, and suggested a meeting with his brother, who was then in Delhi on business. The girl at once identified him as her husband's brother, and from questions and answers which followed, it was found that the detailed description of the house and the circumstances of the death of Mr. Casey's wife were correct in their entirety. The girl also showed keen desire to proceed to Muttra with her brother-in-law of the past life, but as the two families were not even friendly, this could not be arranged. Memory of details confirmed. Mr. Casey was naturally interested in the case, and a little later he came down to Delhi from Muttra with his son, born to the girl in her past life, to see the young lady for himself. As soon as she saw him, she burst into tears and bowed her head in respect. Questioned as to who the two persons were, she did not hesitate to say that one was her husband and the other was her son. She gave details of the husband's likes and dislikes and accurately described the moles and other marks on her husband's body. Mr. Casey confirmed every statement of the girl, to the great surprise of the friends and relations collected in the house. The girl and the boy at once became great friends and seemed very happy together. Very strong evidence was thus given that the girl must have been Mr. Casey's former wife, even though she had reincarnated within 2.5 years of the passing away of her previous physical body. In order to reduce any shock which a sudden parting might have given to the young girl, the advocate took the party for a drive through New Delhi. At every opportunity, the girl and the boy played together and were obviously very happy in each other's company. Indeed, the advocate friend who had seen the girl from her infancy stated that he'd never seen her so happy as on this occasion. Further evidence, if not proof, was given that the girl was indeed a reincarnation of the former wife. Before the party left for the ride, she approached her mother and gave her instructions that certain dishes were to be prepared for the guests and that these were to be served before their final departure. On returning from the drive, Mr. Casey was surprised and to some extent shocked to see that his old favorite dishes, which his deceased wife used to prepare for him, were placed before him. Mr. Casey had to admit that, as the young girl had claimed, he and his wife were a loving pair, and the wife was greatly devoted to him. Legal acceptance of memory of past life. Another account of apparently proven memory of a former life appeared in Adventures in Arabia by W.B. Seabrook. Quoting, "Every soul has previously passed through many human incarnations. The most interesting of the incarnation cases I heard was the story of a certain Mansur Atrash. It is vouched for by dozens of persons in the Jebel. This Mansur Atrash married a girl of 12 by the name of Umrumman, mother of the pomegranate. Shortly afterwards, he was killed in a raid. Those events occurred about 30 years ago. At the exact hour of his death, a fact afterwards verified, there was born to a family of Druzes, hundreds of miles away in the mountains of Lebanon, a boy whom they named Najib Abu Farah. He grew to be 20 years of age without ever leaving his native mountains, and then, by accident, was taken to the Jebel Druze, the old home of Mansur Atrash. As soon as he reached the mountain, he said, 'I must be in a dream. I've seen all these places before. They're more familiar to me than my own mountains. When he came to the village in which Mansur Atrash had lived, he said, "This is my village, and my house is up a certain street, and on a certain corner." He walked through the twisting streets, straight to the house of Mansur Atrash, went to a walled-up recess, had the bricks torn down, and discovered a small bag of money that he remembered having put there in his former life. Later, he was taken to some vineyards belonging to the Atrash family, where there were disputed boundaries. He pointed out the boundaries that he said he had laid when he was Mansur Atrash, and a Druze court of law accepted them. He had now given so many proofs of his identity that he was recognized by the children of Mansur Atrash as their reincarnated father, and received 10 camel loads of grain as a present from the Atrash family. Memory corroborated. Life Digest, May 1944. In an article entitled "This Boy Had Lived Before," published the following example of a memory of a former life. In the latter half of 1922, a 3-year-old Indian boy named Vishwanatha Baraili, India, surprised his parents by giving them minute details of what he claimed was his previous life. The boy pestered his father about a place called Pilibhit, wanting to know how far it was from Baraili, and begging his father to take him there. His father and mother, believing quite erroneously that children with such memories die young, tried everything in their power to make the boy forget his strange fancies. But as he grew older, his preoccupation with his past life grew more intense. Yielding to the boy's entreaties, his parents took him to see the government high school in Pilibhit. The boy said he did not recognize the school. It was, in fact, a new building. Vishwanath then astounded his hearers with a wealth of information about his previous life in Pilibhit. He said that his neighbor had been a Latha Sundar Lal, who posted Green Gate, a sword and a gun, and who held notch parties in the courtyard of his house. He said his father had been a landowner with a great fondness for wine, rohu fish, and notch girls. He claimed that he had studied in the government school, passing in Urdu, Hindi, and English, and reaching the 6th class. All this was subsequently confirmed as correct. He described the house in which he had lived, including its interior, and when taken to the building, everything was found exactly as he described it, including the position of a staircase. The little boy put his finger correctly upon a man in a group photograph as being Ha Narai, finally capping his amazing memory of another life by pointing to himself, a boy seated in a chair. The boy in the photograph was Lakshmi Narain, son of Babu Nai Narain, who had died of lung trouble at Shahjahanpur on December the 15th, 1918, at the age of 32. Among other details given correctly by Vishwanath were the exact site of class 6 in the local school, the appearance of his teacher, the names of places where he had worked, and the name of his personal servant. The boy's maternal uncle corroborated many of these statements, including facts everyone else had forgotten. Memory and faculty recovered. H. Fielding Hall, author of The Soul of a People, published by Macmillan and Co. London, vouches for the case of a little girl of 7 who told him in detail the story of her previous incarnation, in which she said she'd been a man who ran a marionette show. To test her, parents brought her a marionette doll. She at once manipulated the strings quite correctly, although she'd never seen a marionette before. "I've been married 4 times," she said. "2 of my wives died. 1 I divorced, and 1 was living when I died, and is living still. I loved her very much indeed. The one I divorced was a very dreadful woman." Pointing to a scar on her shoulder, she added, "See this? She took a chopper and cut me." Fielding Hall made some inquiries and found that a birthmark on the child corresponded exactly to a mark which had been given to a former owner of a marionette show by his wife, who had been traced. The divorced wife and the much-loved wife were still living, and when asked why she did not go to live with the wife she loved so much, the little girl replied, "But that was all in a former life." In addition, the child accurately described places and people living great distances away that she had never seen and had known only in her previous life. A Reborn Soldier. The following case was printed in the American magazine, New York, July 1915. This story was written by a commercial photographer of Minneapolis. The photographer is the elder sister of Little Annie, and up to the time of the incident, neither she nor any of the family believed in or knew anything of the doctrine of rebirth. Annie, my little half-sister, younger by 15 years, was a queer little mite from the beginning. She did not even look like any member of the family we ever heard of, for she was dark, almost a swarthiness, while the rest of us were fair, showing our Scotch-Irish ancestry unmistakably. As soon as she could talk in connected sentences, she would tell herself fairy stories, and just for the fun of the thing, I would take down her murmurings with my pencil in my old diary. She was my especial charge, my mother being a very busy woman. I was very proud of her. These weavings of fancy were never of the usual type that children's fairy tales take, for in addition to the childish imagination, there were bits of knowledge in them that a baby could not possibly have absorbed in any sort of way. Another remarkable thing about her was that everything she did, she seemed to do through habit, and in fact, such was her insistence, although she was never able to explain what she meant by it. If you could have seen the roistering air with which she would lift her mug of milk when she was only 3 and gulp it down at one quaffing, you would have shaken with laughter. This particularly embarrassed my mother, and she reproved Annie repeatedly. The baby was a good little soul, and would seem to try to obey, and then in an absent-minded moment would bring on another occasion for mortification. "I can't help it, Mother," she would say over and over again, tears in her baby voice. "I've always done it that way." So many were the small incidents of her habits, of speech and thought, and her tricks of manner and memory, that finally we ceased to think anything about them, and she herself was quite unconscious that she was in any way different from other children. One day, when she was 4 years old, she became very indignant with father about some matter, and, as she sat curled up on the floor in front of us, announced her intention of going away forever. "Back to heaven, where you came from?" inquired father with mock seriousness. She shook her head. "I didn't come from heaven to you," she asserted, with that calm conviction to which we were quite accustomed now. "I went to the moon first, but you know about the moon, don't you? It used to have people on it, but it got so hard that we had to go. This promised to be a fairy tale, so I got my pencil and diary." "So," my father led on, "you came from the moon to us, did you?" "Oh, no," she told him in casual fashion. "I've been there lots of times. Sometimes I was a man, and sometimes I was a woman." She was so serene in her announcement that my father laughed heartily, which enraged the child, for she particularly disliked being ridiculed in any way. I was, she maintained indignantly. "Once I went to Canada when I was a man. I remember my name even." "Oh, pooh-pooh," he scoffed. "Little United States girls can't be men in Canada. What was your name that you remember so well?" She considered a moment. "It was Licious Farber," she ventured. Then repeated it with greater assurance. "That was it, Licious Farber." She ran the sounds together so that this was all that I could make of them. "And the name stands in my diary today, Licious Farber." "And what did you do for a living, Licious Farber, in those early days?" My father then treated her with a mock solemnity, befitting her assurance and quieting her nervous little body. "I was a soldier," she granted the information triumphantly, "and I took the gates." That is all that was recorded there. Over and over again, I remember, we tried to get her to explain what she meant by the odd phrase, but she only repeated her words and grew indignant with us for not understanding. Her imagination stopped at explanation. We were living in a cultured community, but although I repeated the story to inquire about the phrase, as one does tell stories of beloved children, you know, no one could do more than conjecture its meaning. Someone encouraged my really going further with the matter, and for a year I studied all the histories of Canada I could lay my hands on, for a battle in which somebody took the gates. All to no purpose. Finally, I was directed by a librarian to a documentary history. I suppose it is a funny old volume with the S's like F's, you know. This was over a year afterwards, when I'd quite lost hope of running my phrase to earth. It was a quaint old book, interestingly picturesque in many of its tales, but I found one bit that put all the others out of my mind. It was a brief account of the taking of a little walled city by a small company of soldiers. A distinguished feat of some sort, yet of no general importance. A young lieutenant, with his small band, the phrase leapt to my eyes, took the gates. And the name of the young lieutenant was Aloysius Lefebvre. Thus, although such detailed memories are the exception rather than the rule, they demonstrate that past lives are not necessarily forgotten. Instinct as memory. Admittedly, physical memory of incidents of past lives is rare, but of memory, as far as innate capacity and knowledge are concerned, there is complete evidence in both the animal and the human kingdom of nature. A theosophical explanation of animal instinct is that it is a form of memory. The soul or consciousness, evolving through ducklings, for example, has evolved through other ducks in earlier times and knows instinctively that ducks can swim. In the new brain, the ducklings do not remember those previous existences, but they brought over the instinct which results from them, and so, quite naturally, they swim. Similarly, all instinctive habits and customs in the animal kingdom are attributable to race memory. Domestic animals frequently display old habits which belong to their earlier phases of evolution, when they were still in a wild state. The dog, for example, will frequently turn round and round before he lies down, because in earlier days as wolf, he had need to tread down his jungle or forest bed to make it comfortable. Like the duckling, he does not remember but follows his instinct, even though in his case the need for the action had vanished. In much the same instinctive fashion, we human beings remember our past lives, our inherent gifts, actually hard-won faculties, our natural sympathies and our antipathies, our remembrances of the past. Love at first sight, that love which springs suddenly into existence and may last for a lifetime, is but the spontaneous renewal of an ancient tie. There are others for whom we feel inborn antipathy, which also has its roots in other lives, when the relationship was not a happy one. We thus bring with us into each new incarnation intuitive rather than detailed memory of old associations. The fruits of these experiences manifest themselves in the new personality as innate faculties, sympathies, and antipathies, which otherwise would be difficult to explain.